Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Elder fraud is on the rise. Last month, the Justice Department, along with multiple law enforcement agencies, conducted the largest coordinated sweep of elder fraud in history, surpassing the previous year's sweep. It involved more than 260 defendants who allegedly victimized more than 2 million Americans, most of them elderly. The total losses at the time of this year's sweep was over $750 million. That's $750 million. As baby boomers age, their life savings are becoming lucrative targets, and scams concocted to snag that money include everything from old-fashioned telemarketing schemes to gaining access to victims' computers. And elder fraud isn't just perpetrated by strangers. Family members and caregivers have been known to swindle people at their most vulnerable. So today we get a clearer picture of the problem, that ways to spot signs of fraud, and hear what authorities are doing to rein it all in. Andrew Murray is the United States Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina. Welcome back. I think this is the first time you've been here since you've moved into your new position from District Attorney.
It is, and thanks for having me.
Well, you're welcome. Nice to have you here again. He's in our Spirit Square studio along with the FBI's Brian Ciprian, Supervisory Special Agent with the Charlotte Field Office's Cyber Task Force. I have to be on my best behavior this morning. Morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to you. And Laura Cole is with us. She's Associate State Director of the Charlotte Region of the AARP. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having us. Good morning.
You're welcome. As we go through the program, you may want to join the conversation. You can. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can even watch us on Facebook Live this morning. Andrew, let me start with you and with a definition, because I'm just curious, because I'm facing it myself. What constitutes elder fraud? Who are elderly people? Where does that start?
I think that if you're asking me, it doesn't start for a long time.
Okay.
I think you'd have to ask AARP what their definition is as to where it starts.
But does the government not have a definition for elder?
I don't believe there's a specific definition.
But you have this thing that you look at elder fraud. How do you know what elder fraud is if you don't know what an elder is?
Consider somebody 65, somebody going into retirement would be. I think AARP has a different definition, but it would be somebody going into their retirement ages.
Okay. What is your definition at AARP?
At AARP, 50 plus is what we
really
consider. That's right. That's right.
You're just trying to expand the membership. Come on.
Well, we want to serve as many people as we can and get as much information out as early as we can. So we want to make sure that folks are getting this information before they hit 65.
Okay. In reading about this yesterday, Andrew, I came across two terms, elder fraud and elder financial abuse. Are they the same thing? Are they interchangeable, or are they different?
They're the same. All frauds are just simply somebody using deceit to fraudulently take the money of our elderly. And it's not always elderly. As you know, there's large groups, but elderly just tend to be more vulnerable and are targeted more than other parts of the population. But all of us get those phone calls.
And do you, does the Justice Department, do local law enforcement people, does the FBI, do you see elder fraud as something discrete from other kinds of fraud? Do you have people dedicated just to elder fraud, or is it just lumped in with all the other scams out there?
Elder fraud's on the rise, and so Department of Justice is really focusing on it. It's a $3 billion industry for those that scam the elderly. And there's enhancements for judges if you take advantage of those that are vulnerable victims, and the elderly are considered vulnerable victims. So, yes, there's a focus and target on elderly, and there's enhancements to help in sentencing for those that commit the crime.
Brian Ciprian is here. He's with the Charlotte Field Office's Cyber Task Force of the FBI. It's a mouthful. All you government guys have long titles. Is elder fraud on the rise partly because of technology?
I would agree, yes. I would say that is the case. A lot of our presence, either through social media, through just networking with our friends and family, our elders are being forced primarily to be on the internet. either through smart devices or their computers. So with that, they put more information about themselves online. It creates opportunities for scammers to target them.
You know, when you talk about elderly people, I think of my grandmother in the 1960s, and she could barely operate the radio. Today's older people have been around computers since the 80s and 90s. They all have smartphones. Many of them have smartphones. They're not doddering old fools. So why are they so susceptible?
Well, as I mentioned, they put a lot of information out about themselves, and there are a lot of scammers who will take that information and target them specifically, giving them a message, hey, this is maybe your grandchild that's in need, or maybe this is something I see in one of your devices, and it's accurate information because they see that.
Yeah.
Then they fall prey to some of those scammers.
We're going to go into some of those particulars of some of those scams in a second or two. Although the Treasury Department and the federal government at large evidently does not define a specific age that refers to elder fraud, Lara, the U.S. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau reports that it is those between 70 and 79 who are hit the hardest. On average, they lose about $45,300 to fraud. People ages 80 and older are the second hardest hit, followed by people 60 to 69, and then 50 to 59. Wow. I mean, why them? Why and why does it start so soon? I would think the average 50-year-old does not think of themselves anywhere near being elderly.
Right. So what we found at AARP is that folks that have a steady income are targeted. And so that can come in the form of a pension. That can be veterans who have a steady income coming in. And so anyone who's got a lump sum of savings, anyone who has money that can be accessed in the form of savings or a steady income is likely to be targeted.
Why do young people not fit that category?
A lot of times young people are moving around in their jobs. They may have an income, but it's not in the form of a guaranteed studied income as somebody who's retired is. Young people also don't have as much savings as elderly people do, and they're a little bit more skeptical about what they see online. And so you get folks that are getting phone calls, and they're really believing that these folks are who they say
are. Are younger people more skeptical about what they see online? I mean, given the fact that you're seeing some things happen to young people who are active on social media that would not happen to somebody were they not on social media.
That is true. When it comes to fraud, for whatever reason, it does appear that when elderly folks get phone calls, they tend to believe that the person on the other end is who they say they are, whereas young people are a little bit quicker to either not pick up the phone at all or not believe that that person is who they say they are.
I never answer the phone.
That's a good thing.
Always the best. It is a good thing.
Yeah.
And because the caller ID, it's all being spoofed now. According to AARP, Lara, if a fiduciary was behind any loss an elderly person experienced to this kind of fraud, the amount of money was steeper than any other category, with the average victim losing $83,600. Define fiduciary. Is that a financial planner or is that a family member taking control of an older person's finances for them?
I can defer to the experts on this. I believe it is either. Whoever you have assigned to take care of your finances, an attorney, a family member who has control of your finances, that is the person who is responsible for your money.
So what you're saying, what the AARP is saying, if I read this correctly, is that if you have somebody taking charge of your money, you are likely or more likely to be scammed and more likely to lose more money to that person. Is that what we're hearing?
And that person has a fiduciary duty or they've taken on the role of a fiduciary duty to take care of them, and then they're exploiting them.
Well, that's very troubling.
It is troubling. A lot of them do it acting, though, as if they have the certifications, if they're financial planners, and in fact they're not. And so the important part for any elder is to make sure they do their homework. Check with that person, check with the Better Business Bureau, check their credentials to make certain that they are who they say they are and that they can do what they say they do. And the biggest thing I'd like to get out of this session is, if it's too good to be true,
it is.
It is.
I was going to bring that up later, but it's embarrassing to be swindled. I mean, you know, everybody loses money in investments and things like that, but it's embarrassing to be swindled by somebody else. And if you are embarrassed, you are less likely to talk about this with anybody else. So could this problem be far bigger than we think it is, because people are just sucking it up and taking it because they're too embarrassed to come forward.
Exactly. I would say that is often the case, even not so much as coming forward, but embarrassed and afraid of losing their independence. If other family members realize that they've been scammed, then maybe they don't have that independence that they should have, and they start to take over. So it's that fear sometimes that prevents them from reporting these types of crimes.
How bad can this get for older people that have been scammed?
Could drain their entire savings.
So they lose all their money, they can lose their car, they can lose their house, and that's when they tell people that they're in trouble.
And then even sometimes they have to come to terms on that.
Wow. In a recent sting, there were not only more victims. Well, let's take it this way. Elder fraud, as you've said a lot, is on the rise. It's based on a sting operation out of the Justice Department that I referenced at the very beginning that was conducted last month. Would you have made that statement prior to that sting, netting more people last month than they netted the year before?
Say it again, whether it's...
Would you have been able to say that elder fraud is on the rise in the absence of that sting?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That was just a culmination of a lot of work. But unless we get the word out as we're doing today, we'll be saying that again next year, because we have a population that is aging. And as that population ages, and here in North Carolina, we also have a population that is moving here to retire here. So our elder population is increasing significantly.
So you, in that recent sting, not only were there more victims, evidently, there were more perpetrators of these scams. At least more perpetrators were apprehended in this scam. Does it follow, then, that more criminals are jumping into this game of cheating older people out of their savings?
It's extremely lucrative. Brian can tell you more about that, but it's an international problem, Mike, and it doesn't have any boundaries.
Sure. As I mentioned, as part of being cyber, there are no boundaries. It's a global problem, a global threat we face, and a lot of them are using technology to affect that. So what we see is a lot of times if they find success in a particular victim age population, then they'll target those again. So they're very opportunistic and will continue going after
a lot of these things happen on the telephone, if I understand this correctly. How do they know who they're calling, or do they? Isn't it just generated by a computer?
You can purchase some of this information. There are various ways they can find some details. There's publicly available information that will kind of help them target in on who you may be. And if they know what your age category is, they can kind of go with a generic scheme to get you talking. One of the things you mentioned earlier was hang up the phone. That's one of the easiest ways to avoid this, on the forefront of it. Hang up the phone and not even entertain these individuals who are looking to scam you.
And when you're called by these new robocall things, not robocalls, these new automated calls where it says, "Hi, it's Margie. How are you today?" That's a recorded, she's not there.
She's not. It's a pause sometimes.
It's a pause for you to respond, and then they can take that response and use that as justification that you ordered the product, right? Because if you say, "Are you fine today?" and you say, "Yes," they just move that over to, "Yes, I want the product."
That very well could happen, yes.
Yes, so don't talk to these people.
Just hang up the phone. That's my advice.
Do we know why elder fraud, obviously it's lucrative, Lara, but do we know why it's on the rise? And are federal, state, local authorities doing enough, in your mind, to get a handle on this?
So I think Brian hit on the why. This is a demographic that has proven to be lucrative. This is a demographic that folks are able to get money out of for one reason or another, and so they're continuing to hit where they're getting success. I think to the second part of your question, folks being here today and doing this really proactive education is what we need to do. What we've found is that once people lose their money, it's very difficult to get back. And so cracking down on prosecution sends a really strong message, and we're very happy about that.
Lara Cole is with the AARP, Brian Cyprian with the FBI, and Andrew Murray, U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina. We'll continue in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about elder fraud and financial abuse with Andrew Murray, the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina. Brian Cyprian is with us, FBI's Special Supervisory Special Agent in the Charlotte Field Office of the Cyber Task Force, and Lara Cole, Associate Director of AARP. Let's talk about cyber fraud here? Because this does affect the elderly, but it affects anybody. Anybody can get sucked into this. The county got sucked into it with a ransom on their computers last year. How is cyber fraud most often done? What kind of scams are you seeing?
A lot of the scams we see are primarily through email, what we call a phishing attack. That's a link coming to you maybe from someone that appears to be trusted and enticing you to click on that link. And then that link will ultimately either deploy malware or will either take information from you that will kind of lead you into.
Can you get snagged into that simply by opening the email, or do you have to click on a link contained in the email?
There are various ones. There could be a poison website that you could go visit that may have some malicious software on it. Additionally, there are what we call a tech fraud scam. Mm-hmm. And basically, that's where you're on your computer and something pops up alerting you that something's wrong with your system.
And if something pops up alerting you that something's wrong with your system, isn't something wrong with your system?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
And especially when they provide numbers and they look very similar to trusted vendors.
Well, how does it get on there? I mean, that's what I'm saying is if something pops up on your system telling you that something's wrong with your system, you've clicked on something that allowed that little thing to be planted on your computer, right?
Very much so. That or they have adware and various other things. Have you ever been shopping on a website and then all of a sudden you're going somewhere else and you see the furniture
pops
that
up
you looked at earlier? There's various tracking mechanisms they can do.
So they're very good, some of these emails are very good at disguising themselves as being legitimate. You'll see legitimate companies' logos.
Yes.
On them, it will be formatted just like something you would get from a major bank or a major retailer. And in fact, they have nothing to do with those organizations. Is there a telltale sign, a way that you can look, somewhere to look, on the email, on the website that it takes you to, whatever, for you to say, that's not real?
Usually I would say the business practice. A lot of them come out even outside of businesses, even from the government, IRS or FBI, and that's just not the normal course of business and how they would communicate with you. So my suggestion would be to avoid the link and try to go directly to that respective website as opposed to clicking on a link to get there.
Well, not to mention a company, but I'm going to. Let's say you get something that looks like an email from the Bank of America.
Mm-hmm.
Now, banks are really good at policing all of this, and they want to know when they've been scammed. But the web address, the link that you're clicking on, you can see the address. And if it doesn't say bankofamerica.com, it ain't the Bank of America, is
right.
it?
Very much so. And then sometimes you have to be careful and look to see if they just didn't transpose a letter.
Ah.
It appears as if it's Bank of America. And you're looking really quickly, you may not notice that. So one of the key tips I give to people is just slow down when you're looking online. When you're getting ready to click, pause before you do so. And anything that's involving any kind of financial transaction or providing your username and password or any type of credential, mm-hmm. just pause before you enter it into something that's come through you unsolicited.
Has everyone around this table gotten phone calls
yes.
from people where you know it's a scam? Everyone is shaking their heads.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. I got one last night just by happenstance. And I've gotten this call before, and I'm going to play it right now.
Hi, this is Samantha from USAPC Healthcare, your computer maintenance company. This call is to inform you that your computer services are not getting compatible, hence your account will be auto-debited today for the renewal of $399. Please call on our helpline number 205-228-8197.
Okay,
for
now,
any
first of all, why would they give their phone number? I mean, that's a federal crime that they've just committed there, right? Isn't it? They're using the telephone mm-hmm. to commit a crime. So they gave us a phone number. Now, if I give that phone number to you, and I will, U.S. attorney, what happens if you get that phone number?
The fact is it's the FBI that will go and do the investigation. But phone numbers, just as Brian just told you, how they're so sophisticated, and they can get adware into your computer. They can go through different servers around this country and around this world and make it so difficult to find where that phone is really doing, because it's being relayed and relayed and relayed to a computer somewhere.
All right. First of all, let's play a little bit of that back again, because I want people to listen to the voice here. Play that back again, Wendy.
Hi, this is Samantha from USAPC Healthcare, your computer maintenance company.
Okay.
This call is to inform
you. Quite clearly a robotic voice with that takes syllables of words and pieces them together. So if you get a call that sounds like that, is that always going to be a scam? Isn't it always going to be a scam?
I'd say more than likely it is, right? The way that sounded, that did not sound legitimate.
Because that is not a human being.
And the next question I would ask is, do I even have that service?
Right. Exactly. Do you have this service? I don't know what she called it, PC something. But a lot of older people may think that because you're online, the company that you bought the computer from or the computer manufacturer or your operating system provider may have access to your computer and know that it's going awry and they're calling to be helpful. That's not the case, right?
No.
Microsoft, Apple, they're never going to call you.
No. The packages and plans are for their availability for you to reach out to them and advise of an issue.
Right. They're never going to call you. They're never going to email you. But occasionally, because I'm a Windows user, you will get updates from,
sure.
from Windows. And it will simply say, can I install this? Well, should I? How do I know it's for Microsoft?
Well, there's some things to authenticate through there. There's a Windows Defender that's usually on the operating system. Various other operating systems have their trusted mechanism and way of doing it. So just go through that process as opposed to something coming directly to the email account.
Okay.
And then know that you've got an update. You see it. You can search for them, what the latest vulnerabilities are, and they'll show what the patches are.
So if I had called that number, chances are I would have gotten somebody who would have asked me to have if I would give permission to give them access to my computer so they could fix what's wrong with my computer. Again, a legitimate computer manufacturer, a legitimate operating system manufacturer is not going to call you and ask you to take control. They may take control if you call them.
Correct.
Okay, so just never, ever, I'm just trying to be clear about this.
You're basically,
never, ever, ever do this.
No, if you're calling them back in a number that you received from a pop-up,
yeah.
And then you give them remote access to your computer, you're basically opening up the keys.
So what happens if you do give access to your computer? What can they, aside from locking your computer and holding it for ransom, if they don't do that, what can they do? What information can they glean from you?
Any and everything that you have on your computer. They could install something that could beacon back out and report information about your computer, your activities. They could take information slowly away from you, pictures, valuable information.
But if you're somebody who uses your computer fundamentally to send email, maybe cruise the web, go on Facebook, post pictures on Facebook, what a value is that to a scammer? Any value at all?
It's additional information they can find about your networks, other people to potentially target. If you've ever shopped online and there's credit card information that's there.
That's stored on your computer?
It can be. Your passwords, sometimes you have options to save passwords.
Within the browser?
Within the browser.
Let me ask you about that. I never allow the browser to save my passwords. Should I?
I don't.
And, Mike, you asked about whether information they can get, even if they're not doing their banking online, even if they're not doing their credit cards online.
Right.
There's information out there like, do you have grandchildren? What are their names? What are their ages? And there's a grandparent scam where you receive phone calls from someone distressed saying that your grandson or granddaughter is in jail and they need to be bonded out and they don't want their parents to know. And can you please send money? And it is a large scam, and that's just because they found out private information.
So those calls are being placed allegedly by whom? An attorney, a sheriff, a police officer saying your grandchild's in jail and we need to bond them out? Who? How do they identify themselves?
It's typically somebody that says they're a friend of the person in jail. Or it's somebody that's posing as the grandson or granddaughter, and they were in an accident or something, and so their voice is not the same. And so they'll act like they have a raspy voice or they have laryngitis and saying, please, please help me, Grandma. I'm stuck here in the jail in Denver, Colorado, and my parents will kill me.
That's the thing. A lot of times they'll use that, I'm too embarrassed to tell my parents, so can you help me? Another issue you will see is it's just time sensitive, so you got to move quickly. Do it right now. So right. They don't really have a chance to process.
And that's a good rule of thumb. If somebody says we need something right now, that's a red flag.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's go back to the not recognizing your grandchildren's voices. Is this really a successful scam and people fall for that? They don't know what their grandchildren sound like?
Yes, unfortunately, I think it is. And I think the urgency and the distress of it all, it could be late at night. It's possible, and it does happen.
Wow.
And it only needs to work one time.
And they found out your grandchildren's names by how?
As we talked beforehand, if you've got a social media presence, you're probably going to post a photo of you and your grandchildren or have their names listed. So you can find that. That's publicly available information. They can kind of put a targeting package against you and just use it.
So if you have a public Facebook page, anybody control it. These scammers control it, find out information about you. How would they then get your phone number? How would they find out that information?
There have been various compromises throughout time that it and allows them to connect dots.
I mean, this sounds like it's more trouble than it's worth from their point of view. It's not, clearly, because they do it, and I guess they can get money out of people. But how do you do that? How long does it take to connect a Facebook page to a telephone number?
I would say not very long if you've
really?
Got the right pieces.
Another reason not to be on Facebook. I'm just adding them up here.
They have plenty of people working for them, and when you're talking, if you're successful across this country 100 times and times 100, then times 100, you're talking multi-million dollar scams. And it's lucrative even if you've got 20 people working for you collecting that information.
And then sometimes it's social engineering, just getting you to provide more information to confirm what they may believe helps connect those dots.
So it's like these psychics. They read your body language and they ask you leading questions, and then they get information that you didn't think you gave them, but enough to make you think that they know all about you.
Well, and the fact is elderly people are a little lonely sometimes, and they like to have conversation, right? And they like to talk. And part of that is just taking advantage of that situation and those discussions, then that makes them vulnerable.
So no one calls grandma or grandpa, and when the phone rings, they want to talk to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
That's what part of the appeal
true.
Is.
And a lot of times their backstory is very truthful. It appears to be mm-hmm. a legitimate company or a business, and this is a very trusting generation. So it comes off pretty good. Not like your robocall, though. That was
right.
not...
a lot of, as you've mentioned, a lot of the people conducting these scams are from what has been described as transnational crime groups, and they masquerade as representatives from Microsoft or Apple or Amazon. Because they're all over the world and because they use computers to bounce phone numbers all over the world, makes them very difficult to apprehend. But even if you could trace them to wherever they are in the world, how could you apprehend them? Could you? Do you have any power? Do other nation states cooperate with you?
There are certain countries that will cooperate with the extradition and that process. There's several that don't. So a lot of these criminals are in those countries that don't really recognize or have a treaty with us for extradition. So that makes it more difficult to go after.
And where are the bad actors generally located?
They're all over.
Don't say Broadway.
They're all over. When I do talks, I always say it could be someone up the street in Greensboro, or it can be someone Eastern Europe, Africa, you name it. That's kind of one of the things that the internet creates is ability to mask yourself.
And Mike, you said it can be difficult, especially countries that do not agree to extradite. But there was a success story this weekend where the FBI, we had a sealed indictment for somebody that exploited many in this country out of millions, and there was a watch list on him, and he happened to travel to South Korea. Mm-hmm. And South Korea helped us to extradite him back here to face the charges that had been sitting out there for a long time. So we have a long arm, and we can get to many of them.
So what are you hearing from members at AARP? I know that you AARP produces a monthly magazine, and there are articles about this all the time. What kind of scams are you hearing about that elderly people have fallen for and lost considerable sums at?
So we're hearing about the grandparent scams a lot. We hear a lot about the romance scams as well, people taking advantage of seniors that are by themselves. A recent scam that we've heard a lot about is actually somebody calling saying they're from the Social Security Administration and demanding your Social Security number and saying that there's all kinds of bank accounts that have been opened in your name and threatening charges against you. That is one that is recently that we've heard a lot.
Never. First of all, I have the U.S. attorney here. It is my impression that the Social Security Act of 1930, whatever it was, prohibits the use of your Social Security number as an identifier. Is that true?
It is.
Then why is it you can't do anything without giving your Social Security number out?
Well, I think that they're getting away from that, and they're starting to give specific IDs and getting away from Social Security. When I joined the military many years ago, that was your ID for everything, and that is now everybody has a personal ID number.
I don't.
You don't?
No.
Well, you need to get one.
How?
you can sign up with Social Security, and you can get away from Social Security and get an ID number to get in and to be identified outside of just a security number.
Yeah, but you sometimes can't open a bank account. You sometimes can't apply for a loan. You sometimes can't do a lot of things without giving your Social Security. I've said, no, I'm not going to give it to you. Well, you're not going to get that. We can't open the account. They've told me that.
That's true.
And it's illegal.
Well, when you say it's illegal, I'm not sure.
It's not supposed to be used as a personal identification number except for Social Security. I'm getting off topic here because it's
it's annoying.
It's annoying. All right, so let's go back to this situation where somebody asks you on the phone for your Social Security number. Never give it. And the Social Security Administration knows your Social Security number, correct?
Right, and they're not going to call you and ask you for it. This is a scam, and it is dangerous, and it is scary. I've actually gotten the call myself. It is scary to have somebody call you and say, somebody has done all these fraudulent things in your name. We think it might be you, and you're going to go to jail if you don't call us back and give you your stuff.
And these are people who have spent their lives usually abiding by the law. So when you are being told that somebody has broken the law in your name and you're in trouble for it, mm-hmm. your reaction is, oh, my gosh, I've got to fix this, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and to comply and abide with what you think is the law.
Can you think of an instance where that's legitimate, where you really do need to fix this? I'm looking at you, Andrew. It's always going to be fraudulent.
It's going to be fraudulent. I mean, there are certain – when compromised, the bank will contact you, and if your bank account's been compromised, right, they will ask you questions. First of all, they get you to identify who you are. They'll get some identified information. If you're not comfortable with that phone call, certainly call them back, okay. Right, find it. And then once you establish that they are who they are, then they will assist you in that. But it's always going to be a scam.
Okay. In the next segment, I'm going to give out my Social Security number on the air. No, I'm not. I'm actually not going to do that. Andrew Murray is here from the Western District of North Carolina. He's the U.S. Attorney. Brian Ciprian's with the FBI. Lara Cole with AARP. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about elder fraud, which is a growing problem throughout the country. Andrew Murray is here. He's the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina. Brian Ciprian's with the FBI's Cyber Task Force. And Lara Cole, Associate State Director of AARP. When people are called on the phone and enticed successfully to send money someplace, are they sending a wire transfer? Are they putting a bunch of cash in an envelope and mailing it? How is the transaction taking place?
It's several ways. One is to go get preloaded cards.
Gift cards.
And as soon as the person on the other line, as soon as you get gift cards, they want to know the information off the back, basically the SKU number, and they can empty that card immediately. There's other ways of sending a check to what we call money mules. People here, some of them have been duped by heart bomb scams. And
what is that?
That is somebody that establishes a relationship, gets their confidences, and then says that they are hurting for money or their bank account's been closed. Can you please, this money's being sent to you, can you send it forward to me? And they're being duped to basically be a money launderer, to take that money and send it overseas to other places.
In what universe would somebody believe that?
Well, it goes back to the grooming. A lot of these are definitely romance scams. They start to fall for the individual over the course of months, maybe years, and then they just believe this person needs their help.
That's what you mean by heart bone.
Yes.
Okay, these are people that are ingratiating themselves into another person's life, proclaiming that they love them?
Exactly. And then oftentimes, like when we, from a cyber standpoint, when hackers overseas compromise, let's say, bank accounts in the U.S., that money's here. They need the money back overseas. So yeah. Then these individuals, the elderly often, will be the ones to go have the money directed to their accounts, take that money, and then wire it overseas.
Okay, so aren't those wires traceable? And isn't the money retrievable if it's traceable?
Within a certain amount of time. Usually you're looking at about a 72-hour window of having success on getting those funds back. If they've got money mule networks that are going, taking small structured amounts from those accounts, the money's gone if you wait too long. And failure to report is one of the biggest things. So if you're sitting and too embarrassed to report, then it's not known.
So if you're using banks to accomplish this, are banks, obviously they're aware that this happens, are they in a position to be aware that perhaps you're involved in a scam when even you aren't aware?
Sometimes they're flagged, and we've seen that, to where, like, this didn't seem right. You've got a large deposit that came in, and now you're trying to withdraw it and wire it. Do you know this person? There's several questions, even with Western Union and MoneyGram. Do you know where you're sending the money? Is it international? People still send.
But the bank and Western Union can't stop you from doing what you want to do. But can they get themselves into trouble by being too intrusive? I mean, there are privacy issues involved in here, and these could be legitimate transactions, and quite frankly, it's none of your business. So how do they ask those questions?
True. If there's no flag of fraudulent activity, then a lot of times those questions aren't asked.
I think they can, however. If you have a teller that's used to seeing somebody that comes and does their banking twice a month, and all of a sudden they're coming in and they're doing something unusual, and that is they immediately need a $5,000 money order or a $10,000 money order, and then 2 days later they're coming in again, or they're depositing unusual checks from places, that's a red flag. They could ask questions, ask them about it, or they can file a suspicious report based on that information for others to try to look into it. But there are commercial establishments that can be more aware in order to help those that are being taken advantage of.
So we have these situations where strangers from around the world are conducting these scams. But more troubling, to me personally at least, is that these happen more frequently among people who know the victim. Either they're a family member of the victim, somebody with a fiduciary responsibility to the victim, or a caregiver to the victim. Are these more frequent, more lucrative, harder to spot? Lara?
I think that's a great question. They may be, for the person involved, it may be harder to accept that this is happening from somebody that they know. And one of the things at AARP that we really want to...
And love and trust.
And love and trust could be. Yeah. And trust is really, I think, the biggest part of that. If you've entrusted somebody with your money, you don't think that they are going to take it from you.
Right.
One of the things that we really want to stress that we've talked about a little bit before is really making sure that we're having these conversations and that people are not afraid to talk about what's happening with their money, what they think might be happening with their money, or if they think something is off, make sure that they're okay to talk about it.
Well, the Justice Department reported on a certified nursing assistant in a retirement community who was charged with identity theft, forgery, general theft, fraudulent use of a credit card. Is that frequent or is that the rarity?
I think it happens fairly. Whenever somebody has that much contact, has the ability to get to know someone really well and somebody that's vulnerable, then unfortunately there is a lot of opportunity for abuse there, and it happens way too frequently, whether it be a nurse's aide, whether it be a next-door neighbor, a supposed friend that comes to take advantage. And from the criminal aspect, you asked about whether it's more prevalent. I'm not sure it's more prevalent. I think it's a significant amount of the fraud. But it usually starts off slow, where somebody takes a little bit of advantage, takes a check out, does something, and then it just continues to ramp up. And it goes for a long time usually because that individual trusts them. And so with that trust, it can go on for months and years before anybody decides. And a lot of times then the nest egg is gone.
So that leads to some questions that people have emailed us. Dennis emails, how prevalent is elder abuse and financial fraud perpetrated by family members on unsuspecting seniors? Is there a way to quantify that?
I went to some training, and out of the $3 billion a year, they think it's about 50-50 as for your scams that are coming from phone calls and people knocking on your door and financial, and those that are trusted.
According to the Wall Street Journal, when it comes to scams involving the transfer of money from target accounts to someone else's, the amount that people are defrauded is far greater when the perpetrators are known to the targets, family members, friends, romantic partners that you mentioned. They report the average loss to strangers of elderly people in these scams is about $17,000. When it comes to family members and trusted people, $42,700. And in cases involving non-family caregivers, $57,800.
That's because they ramp up quickly and take the money.
How do you vet these non-family caregivers? There's a lot of them going around now because people need them. They need those people.
Right. And we need to take care of our elderly, and those that have any relationship with elderly just need to look for signs, right? They need to just look for if they're being isolated with somebody that they all of a sudden are just keeping them away from other family members or other friends, and they're doing everything. And they need to look for signs if you're visiting your grandparent and they do have an elder caretaker, and all of a sudden you see some money order receipts sitting around, right? That should be a clue. Why are they there? Do they need money orders? Just looking for signs and checking into. There should be always somebody checking behind to make sure they're taken care of.
Mary Lee writes, years ago when I was a social worker, I had an elderly client who was legally blind and very hard of hearing. He owned a substantial house but had no savings. His two sons did not like the way he had his will written. They took him to a lawyer. He thought he was signing a paper which would allow repairs to be made to the house. In reality, he signed a paper allowing his sons to sell his house and split the money. Because he no longer had access to an asset that should have been his, Medicaid would not pay for him to enter a facility. He was forced to live with one of the sons who had taken his asset. Is that a crime?
Absolutely. It's a tragic story, and it's something that we will prosecute every time.
Is it a crime that's difficult to prove? Because obviously he thought he was doing one thing.
It was a fraudulent transaction for the purpose of a personal gain. Now it's not hard to prove, and it's something that we would certainly take on.
If you think someone is scamming you or you have been the victim of a scam, what do you do? What should you do? Who do you report it to?
That's often one of the issues people have. They don't know who to report to. I would suggest the Internet Crime Complaint Center, www.ic3.gov. You can go on, report that information. It'll come to whatever field office for the FBI, and we can review it.
Give us that address again.
www.ic3.gov.
The number 3?
Yes, sir.
IC number 3.
Correct. G-O-V.
G-O-V. We'll put that on our website.
Internet Crime Complaint Center. You put in the information, provide as much details as you can, and that information will be routed to a field office for further investigation. If you fail to report, then it's hard to really follow up on those things.
If you've lost money in a scam and you're smart enough or quick enough, or you've just heard this program and you've gotten that address, is it likely that it's too late to get your money back? By the time it goes through the channels that you have to report it through and you guys get involved and start is it too late?
Once again, if it's wire transfers, usually about a 72-hour window. So if you feel like you just sent that off, maybe just call the local field office, FBI field office here in Charlotte, FBI.gov. You can fill up a local office, or if you have one of the contacts. That would be the quickest way, because through our process, we can reach out to the banks and probably try to hold that money for you.
So not every caregiver and not every family member is trying to scam the elderly. Some people are actually trying to look out for them. And the government suggests that if you are a caregiver, whether you're a family member or not, that you pay attention to the elderly persons, to the mail that they get, to the phone calls that they receive, to what they're saying on those phone calls. That sounds on the face of it, like a smart idea. On the other hand, it's a terrible invasion of privacy, isn't it? How do you deal with it? How do you recommend people deal with this, Laura?
It's a balance, and this is where AARP resources can really come in very handy, not just for the 50-plus, but for those who are caregivers, because we have a lot of conversations that we have suggestions for how to have, whether it be somebody who is no longer driving very well, or whether it be, as you mentioned, keeping track of somebody who is needing a little bit of help, watching their finances, watching what's happening, and you can set up boundaries with folks so that everybody's comfortable with this situation. AARP does have resources for this, and we want to emphasize that these resources are free to the public. We have volunteers all over Charlotte. Our Charlotte Volunteer Network teaches classes in the libraries where we talk about these scams. These scams can be a moving target, and so we want to be able to talk about what's going on right now.
And if you are one of those people who has been asked to go to your bank and make a wire transfer or withdraw cash and take it and buy gift cards and send the gift cards or whatever, however it works, would it behoove you, not that you'll do this, but would it behoove you to have a conversation with the branch manager to say, this is what I've been asked to do. What could this be real? I mean, are people likely to do that? Do branch managers get asked that, or tellers for that matter, get asked that question?
I'm not certain. I don't know if I can answer for that, but I think it's a great idea for them to ask, like, hey, I've been instructed to do this. Does this sound fraudulent?
Because banks evidently are beginning to train tellers and other personnel in what to look for and questions to ask if they think that person is being harmed.
Right.
That's why they're there to withdraw money. So shouldn't they be putting up signs saying this could be a scam? Just in general, these are the signs to spot. Wouldn't that be helpful for banks to do?
Sure.
But a lot of people don't go inside the bank anymore. They just do it on their phone or the ATM.
It's on the phone and it happens so quickly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mike, I'd like to recommend that many family members, they become isolated. And so really what people need to do, caretakers, loved ones, is make sure you're in contact with that loved one regularly. When they're going weeks without any contact, that's when bad things can happen. If you're having regular conversations, regular contact, then you can know, oh, why did you go to the bank yesterday? Mm. And you can ask questions, but you have to have that dialogue.
I want to go back to romance for just a second. When you talk about romantic scams, where this person has ingratiated themselves into the life of an elderly person, how are the elderly meeting these people? Is it through dating apps on your phone?
Yes.
Really?
Online. They're meeting online.
Online dating through legitimate sites?
Could be, yeah.
Where people are lurking to take advantage of older people?
Yes. That's exactly right.
How prevalent is that? I mean, how often does that happen?
It's frequent. Romance scams are one of the most common, I believe, right now that we see.
And do they actually physically meet these individuals that they meet online, or is it all conducted?
It's all online frequently.
Really?
Yes.
Now, these are people who have life experience. They've been around the block. They're not teenagers.
But there are also people who may be recently widowed, divorced, and kind of back in on the market for
very,
dating.
Very vulnerable.
So some desperation.
Wow. They're lonely.
Yes.
Yes.
And any attention is welcomed.
Yes.
And it's cultivated. It's initially a few phone calls, and then it just cultivates into a long-term relationship with, and eventually it is, you know, we're going to get together, or we're going to get married, and next thing you know, but I need money.
Mm-hmm. What are some best practices before we leave all this today? Best practices, common sense or common rules of thumb for people to follow. If they're called on the telephone, if they get an email, if suddenly something does pop up on your computer, if in fact you do download some malware and it does take over your computer, what should you do?
I would say on the first one, it's okay to hang up the phone. If it's an unsolicited phone call or number you don't recognize, it's okay to hang up the phone.
That is a problem with older people, because before caller ID, we answered every call. And now, with caller ID, if you don't recognize the number, there's no reason for you to answer the call,
if
right?
If they need you, they can leave a message.
Exactly right. And you can call them back. So what else? Rules of thumb.
Just slow down online when you're clicking. Be careful where you're going. If this, once again, you get an email, anything for your banks, any kind of financial transaction, go directly to that bank. Don't necessarily click through the link that may have come through the email, because it could be malicious.
Yeah, that's a great topic. If you get an email from a bank, your bank, don't click on the link. Go to your bank's website.
Right.
Get out of that. Open a new browser. Go to your bank website.
And if you need to update information, you can do it within that.
Brian Ciprian, FBI Supervisory Special Agent with the Cyber Task Force. Andrew Murray with Western District of North Carolina U.S. Attorney. Lara Cole with AARP. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.